Welcome again, listeners, to a brand new episode of The Process. I am joined today with my secondary co-host here, Jeremy Holt, and we are doing a sensation spectacular. We have Mr. Scott Snyder with us today. We are very excited about this, and if you haven't heard of Scott Snyder, well, that's craziness, but Scott is a very, very prolific, busy writer. He's the guy behind American Vampire with Vertigo. He is doing Severed. He is also writing for the DC Universe with a bunch of the relaunch titles that came in this last few months with Batman and Swamp Thing. And he's decided to take a little bit of time out of his schedule, and he's going to chat with us about his projects. So, gentlemen, how are we doing tonight?
Great, man. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We really appreciate you having out. I know it's Halloween. It's busy for, people with kids. I'm not one of those people, so, I have no real excuse. But we do appreciate you coming on and talking to us today, so...
Sure, man. We just got back. I was saying from trick or treating with our kids. We got a 4-year-old and a 4-month-old, and we went in Star Wars theme. Last year we were Batman, and I was Robin. He was Batman, and my 4-year-old. And this year, he was Darth Vader, and I was a stormtrooper. So he wanted his baby brother to be Jabba the Hutt, but there was no way to do that. We couldn't find like a one of those little rats in time to put on his shoulder. So he was Yoda instead.
So did you go out and like buy the costumes, or is this like all homemade? Did you like craft the mask and everything?
No, we were lazy. It was all ordered. There wasn't anything, nothing that elaborate. But I'll tell you this: the stormtrooper costume was pretty impressive. I mean, just in terms of the plates of it, like it had shoulder pad, everything. It's really good. I mean, it had a 2-piece mask, everything. I'll give it like George Lucas and that whole thing. That I mean, definitely. See, the costumes are quality.
That's badass, because I remember growing up, I was kind of a poor kid, so I grew up with like the homemade, I was always a pirate, because those are things you can make out of you could just cut up the old clothes that you didn't wear anymore.
Or as a ghost.
I definitely didn't have the bought masks or anything like that. So, I mean, that's pretty badass parenting right there.
it was good. It's a labor of love. But it was fun. Yeah, we got back just a little while ago.
Awesome. Well, we actually got a chance to run into you at the New York Comic Con a few weeks ago. And I was just wondering, how'd the show go for you?
It was really good. I mean, I barely made it off that small patch of carpet that was the DC pavilion. I feel like I sort of like was just rooted there most of the time. But overall, I mean, it was great, just because New York is my hometown, and a lot of my students came, and my family could come see me there. And it's also, you can kind of get out of the con and go places that as opposed to being sort of adrift on like a tiny island of some kind, in some other places, or at least that's how it feels. So it's great. I love New York. It was a real pleasure.
Was that your first time being at the New York show, or had you gone last year?
No, it's my third time, but I it was definitely the craziest time so far. I used to go back in the day before I was in comics, and I used to go to the ones before there was that Comic-Con, when there used to just be those little ones over in by Penn Station in that hotel where they filmed that Maury Povich show now. I was trying. It was funny. I was doing an interview with MTV Geek, by the way, which is the weirdest interview I've ever done, where it was me and Jeff Lemire, and the guy who was interviewing us, Chris, I think his name's Chris Hardwick, and he was like, "So, you guys just wanted to know, like, when you guys founded Vertigo Comics, like, how you never expected it to become what it is today, right?" Me and Jeff were just like, "What?" He was like, "Well, you couldn't have imagined that all these great comics would have come out of it." I was like, "What are you talking about?" It was so weird. We just started laughing, and he was like, what? And the guy was like, "They didn't found Vertigo. They write for Vertigo." And we were like, "Oh, yeah, well, I was in 8th grade, so when I..."
discovered Alan Moore.
Yeah, it was like when I was on my way to gym class, and we thought of Vertigo together. So it was pretty funny. But I was explaining to him what Maury Povich... Then it went so off the rails, that interview, that it was basically... And the funniest thing is it was live streaming, and then I can't find it. I actually was like asking all my friends to look it up. I'm like, "You have to find this interview. I really want to see it. It must have been hilarious." But I can't find it. They didn't post it on MTV or anything.
That sucks.
I was like,
sometimes it takes a while.
What?
It might show up in a few weeks or something like that. I remember I did one with them in Seattle. It took like 2 months before really? It came out. Yeah, but the funniest part about that was because I'm in Canada, you can't watch MTV America. They block it. So I posted it on my Facebook. I'm like, yeah, I was interviewed by MTV. And like everyone that wanted to go see it were like, you liar. You can't even watch it. So nobody believed that I was interviewed by MTV. So.
Yeah, I was even like sick and bleeding cool on it. I was like, you guys have to find this interview. It's so funny. So I don't know. I'm really hoping that that somebody digs it up. So, but yeah, I wound up trying to describe what the Maury Povich show was at the end. I was like, no. And then they're like, you are not the father. And they like dance around. And
my favorite of the Maury Povich is the, you know, if is it a man or a woman? And, you know, it's like, oh, hey, yeah. Maury, that's a man. He got an Adam's apple. It's like, you know, the same thing every time. It's always the Adam's apple that gives it away.
I know. I've seen those too. That Maury has those too. It used to be, I remember back in the day, it was pretty funny. You used to have like, you know, it was like Ku Klux Klan and Black Panthers both on the same stage and all that. Now all it is like, you are not the father, man or woman, and my teen is out of control. That was one of the funniest where a Cartman went on and pretended to be an out of control teen. Did you ever see that? He goes on Maury Povich because he wants to win a prize if he's the most out of control teen.
What?
And he's always like, what? I do what I want. This is so fun. Anyway, enough. I feel like we better get to the craft stuff because I feel badly that my baby might wake up.
Well, yeah. So the New York Comic Con for you was pretty good. Did you do any panels or anything like that, or was it mostly signings?
Yeah, no, I did a few panels. I did the two Vertigo ones. There was one that was like a bigger Vertigo one about everything coming up. So I did that for American Vampire, and then there was another one the next day that was more intimate. That was about what's specifically coming up in each book and had more interior art. So we did that for American Vampire as well. And then for DC, I did the Batman panel, which was a lot of fun, where I got to sit up there with Greg Capullo and talk about what's coming up in Batman. And I did the Dark and the Edge one, too, which was for Swamp Thing. And that was a blast because all those guys – I'm really close with all those guys, too, as I am with the Batman crew. But with the Dark and Edge people, a lot of them I don't get to see as much. The Batman crew were pretty, like, East Coast-centric, you know, so – I see, like, Pete Tomasi and talk to him and Tony Daniel. I know he's in Chicago, but we talk pretty often. And Kyle Higgins, even though he's West Coast, we talk a lot. So the Batman stuff is, like, pretty looped in together. But the Dark and the Edge stuff, even though we talk often, we don't live close to each other. So it's really nice to get to see all those guys.
So you find with your, especially, like you said, Batman, a lot of the people you work with are in town. So do you guys actually get together and meet in person, or is it over Skype, or...?
Yeah, I mean, we talk on the phone mostly just because most of us, you know, have families and stuff like that. It's tough to, like, meet in the city. But we've met a few times in the city. Like, we met – I guess it was just last month. I think it was just last month. I met Pete Tomasi and Paul Jenkins, and Tony Skyped with us, Tony Daniel, and who else was it? And I forget. I mean, I think that there was – you know, we kept Gail looped in and, you know – emailed with her and everything too, so it was, and Pete was there, so it was, we do meet and talk a lot. I mean, Mike Martz does a great job about keeping us abreast of what each other is doing, so, like, yeah. For example, in Batman 4, there's like one or two panels where it's a flashback to when Bruce is a kid, and there's something that conflicts with something Pete was doing, and he saw it because we trade all of our scripts. And so he asked if we could change that one panel, and it was no big deal because we trade everything, you know. So that kind of stuff is really helpful, and it's nice. We build a common mythology, and our Batman is going to cross over with a couple other books soon. So, and influence those books, and they'll influence Batman as well, but especially with, like, Nightwing and stuff like that. So it'll be fun.
How do you find, like, does that slow down your writing process, or does it actually facilitate better writing, or are you able to get more done that way?
Well, I really feel, I mean, for me, one of the greatest things about working in comics is the collaborative aspect. I mean, coming from a literary background, the thing I disliked about it the most, even though I mean, it's kind of funny because I thought I was really happy doing that, and I enjoyed it, but it was pretty grueling just in its loneliness, I think, all the time, that you work on something all by yourself in a cave, and as rewarding as it is when it's done, it's just very isolating. And so for me, working in comics, there are a lot of things that I really fell in love with very quickly, and love even more than I do literary writing. But one of the major aspects right off the bat was the collaborative stuff. So having sounding boards, especially for stuff that you can brainstorm and show, because with literary fiction, you know, I have friends like that too, but it's harder, I guess, to show pieces of stuff or brainstorm, because they look at it for the prose and that kind of stuff too. So with comics, you can talk broader strokes, and having guys like Pete, who you can show stuff to, or especially, like, I trade everything with Jeff Lemire. He's my closest friend in comics. We trade outlines and scripts and everything. And having that, those kinds of sounding boards around all the time, to me, is essential. You know, nothing is created in a vacuum, and at least in my world. Like, you know, whether it's literary fiction or that, it's always you get help from an editor, or help from... The more help you can have from people you trust, that's the real valuable stuff. I mean, I tell my students that all the time, and in writing class in graduate school and college too. I teach fiction workshops, and then now I teach comic writing, and always say the same thing. Like, my closest friends as writers, from the literary world, were people that I met in college workshop and people I met in grad school workshop. And, you know, the people that you meet whose judgment you trust about your own work is really, really important. It's important to keep those people really close to you, you know? So there's really no greater asset and sounding board than, you know, that kind of an objective view that you really trust. So I love having them around. It makes it a lot easier for me.
How did you make that connection with Jeff Lemire? Is that simply just through the Vertigo connection, or did you outside of the actual writing front?
Well, it's kind of funny, because I got in touch with him, I guess it was right before we both started, to work for DC, when I had been reading Essex County and that kind of stuff. And just through, I think it was through Twitter, or I don't remember if it was Facebook or Twitter, but then what happened was we both started writing. He started writing Sweet Tooth right around the time that I was pitching American Vampire. And when American Vampire went through, I got in touch with him telling him how much I like Sweet Tooth. And he, you know, wrote back about he had read some of my stuff. And so we just got really close fast, just because we have really similar sensibility. And we both went through the thing where we were asked about signing contracts pretty early, you know, I think mostly just because we had the Vertigo series. So Dan and those guys approached us pretty quickly about, do you want to stay for 2 years and that stuff. And both of us, I think it made our heads spin a little bit, since we were so excited and also nervous about it. So that also sort of cemented our friendship, just because we sort of went back and forth a lot talking about what made the most sense and all that stuff. So I guess it was then. So we've been friends a few years now, and really, you know, he's one of my best friends now. I consider him outside of comics as well, too.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the things that I've noticed about. I just had a conversation actually with some friends of mine, and I have a novel coming out in a few weeks, and they're all asking, like, oh, are you excited? And it's like, I don't know. I just don't have the same level of excitement that I do when I put a script out there and an artist puts it together, and you talk about it and you discuss the story together. And when that product comes out, it's a combination of a lot of people's excitement, and it just doesn't compare to like novel writing. You're right, it's very insular, so I can definitely understand that.
It is insular, but congratulations, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm excited.
What's the novel? Well, you know, it's a novel, it's a smallish thing, but you know, it is what it is. It's one of those things where I wrote it years and years ago, and it was just sitting on my hard drive, and I'm like, maybe now that I've got a few comics published, maybe that someone will listen to me now. And yeah, you know, sure enough, it did. So it I guess it panned out to follow through with it. But you were touching on before about teaching. How did that all happen?
When I finished grad school, I went to grad school for writing about a year after college. The first I took a year off right after college, and I went down to Florida and I worked at Disney World for a year. And then I sort of traveled around a little bit, and then I started working at Columbia, which was my alma mater, because they asked people back that, I mean, when I started grad school, the opportunity sort of came up to teach in a small capacity there and stuff. So I taught there, and then I taught high school for a year when I was done with grad school. I taught through the BOCES program through to high school seniors, and then once I sold my book, my collection of short stories, it's called Voodoo Heart. It came out in the end of 2006. Then teaching jobs opened up sort of more easily at different colleges. So I taught at writing fiction at Columbia, as an adjunct, and I taught at Sarah Lawrence, and I taught at NYU, and I started teaching out here where I live in Long Island at SUNY out here. And then once I started to get into comics, I started asking if they'd be interested in comic courses, and most of them were. So I've taught comics now in the graduate programs at NYU and Sarah Lawrence, and now at Stony Brook as well. So it's been a lot of fun. At this point, it's sort of embarrassing to say, but you know, teaching it pays so poorly in general that, you know, I really make more almost from one issue, from writing one issue at this point, than I do from teaching like almost an entire semester. So and that's not because I make so much writing. I just mean that's, you know, certainly two issues. Even when I started out, I made more from two issues at base salary than I did from teaching a full semester. So, you know, for me, it really is just something I like to do because I feel like it keeps you really young as a writer, because you go in there and the golden rule of the class is always, you know, like right now, my students are about to hand in their first drafts of their scripts. And, you know, I always say it's sort of like the golden rule is basically you have to just write the comic that you want to read. It doesn't matter if it's the best or the smartest or the funniest or anything like that. It just needs to be the one that you'd like to walk into the store and read more than any other one in the world. It has to be your favorite one right now. And if you say that enough to the kids, or they're not kids, some of them are older than me, you go home and, you know, you feel like a hypocrite if you don't try and do the same thing, I think. So I feel like it keeps you honest, and, you know, it's exciting to get people excited about books like The Dark Knight Returns and Alan Moore's Swamp Thing or Day Trippers or any of the stuff you get to teach in their fun home. So it's a blast. I like teaching a lot.
It's really cool.
Jeremy, you've been quiet. You got any questions over there, buddy?
Yeah, I guess my question is, you know, you have a series with Image doing Severed, which I really like and I'm a huge fan of. And I was just curious, because, you know, you have a lot of continuity you have to work with as far as DC is concerned. But with Image, does it feel like, you know, obviously you have more work involved getting the book done, but is it freeing in a way that doing creator own work that way, or is it, do you like having the support of an editorial staff and all that from Vertigo?
You know, there's a bit of both. I mean, I know it's a good question. Like, the thing that's most exciting about doing it, the stuff at Image, is just that I'm working with my oldest and best friend from, we've been friends since we were 13, and Scott Tuft, and he is a film guy, so it's really fun. It's the first time I've actually co-written anything. I've done story by, you know, co-writing that or co-creating a Gate to Gotham and stuff like that by doing story by with somebody else, with Kyle. But with this, it really was actually passing a script back and forth and co-writing it. So that element of it was really interesting and liberating and difficult and all that stuff, because I feel like we have different sensibilities, and I think the script and the series is richer for the combination. In some ways, I think it's a lot better for his input than it would have been if I did it myself. I feel like it's much more tempered and patient and cumulative with this kind of slow build horror. But in terms of the actual production of it, you know, there's things that are really great about it, and there's things that are extremely frustrating and difficult. So, you know, it's a lot more difficult with any company. Image has been really nice to us, and they've been great about, you know, helping us figure out how to do publicity and helping us figure out a lot of things like the Diamond stuff. And so Eric and all that his whole team has been really good, but it's still difficult to learn how to do all of those things. Like, just letters alone, like, you know, finding a letter, figuring out rate, making sure that instead with Vertigo, I have as many passes as I want on a script or on a lettering pass. So if I get letters and I decide I want to change something else, I can just write the letter and say, you know, I want to change something else a week later. But with this, each time you make a round of changes, you have to pay them. So, you know, all of it is difficult to figure out, I guess, is the sort of brutally honest answer, where there's – it becomes a lot more of a lot more labor intensive. But that said, it's very exciting to see the final product, to know that you controlled and sort of were responsible for every little aspect of that, because you – there's a tremendous pride that comes with that, saying I chose these colors, I chose this lettering, I chose this and that. And it's a very fully realized vision in that way, whereas – you know, it's more collaborative in terms of things that are out of your hands at DC and Vertigo in other ways, I guess, is the best way to put it, you know?
So you were saying that it's co-written with your friend. How do you co-write a comic script? I'm curious. Do you both just share the actual writing of the script, or do you just bat the story around and pass the script back and forth?
We usually kind of bat it back and forth in terms of, we wrote it, I mean, it's done now, so we wrote it a while ago because I knew I'd have a lot of DC stuff. So we worked on it a few months ago, we finished it up. So we did it when we had more time and we met together. He lives in LA and in New York. And so when he was in New York, we would pass it back and forth in terms of, you know, I'd say, I really like this scene from this script or issue 4. Do you mind if I do this? Then I'll give it to you for the next scene. And sometimes he'd say, you know what, do you want to take a pass at issue 5? And then I'll come in and change it. And so, sure. So it was, we sort of did it on the fly. I mean, there were some things like scenes that I wrote and some parts that really he did the lion's share on. And overall, I would definitely give him a lot more credit than me for that, the series, because I've been so heavily, and he deserves it. I mean, 100%. It's just, even though, you know, we wrote it together, he's really done the larger portion of the production of the series, and he's been much more involved with Attila, the artist, who we're really proud of on it and everything. So, you know, as much credit as I can throw towards Scott and Attila, I'd love to, because, you know, if there's like a third wheel or somebody who's piggybacking on it, it's me and not them.
So did you actually go out and find the artist, or like, or
yeah,
was that
Jeff Lemire recommended him? Actually,
oh wow,
yeah, Jeff. We were looking for people and looking at different people, and Jeff was like, oh, you know, this guy might be really good given the tone of the piece. And we spoke to him, and he did some sample stuff, and we really liked him. And he came to New York last year. It was last year in New York where we met him, Attila, and he brought some pages, and we really liked them a lot. And, you know, we couldn't be happier with the work that he's turning in. It's very exciting to see. So we wanted it to look really different and have a kind of, you know, sepia tone kind of quality to it. Look almost like a storybook, sort of realistic, but also kind of wistful feel to capture the optimism of that time. And then also hopefully underscore some of the terror of it when it turns, you know, darker. So, yeah, so we met him last year, and he's been terrific.
Scott, my question that you just brought up, you're talking about art. Did you have any kind of art background, or was it just years of reading comic books, knowing, you know, articulating what you want? Because I realized that, you know, a lot of writers starting out, they might write well, but they may not have an art bone in their body, so they don't understand composition or color or, you know, any of these things. But was that something that you kind of learned, or you've always kind of had a knack for?
Well, I'm not sure I have a bone of it, like, anywhere in my body. But I have always, growing up, I wanted to be a comic book illustrator all the way through high school. So I used to, that was what I wanted to do. And I was pretty good at it at that age. I mean, I had a portfolio and all that stuff like that I used when I applied to college, and I took courses outside of school. And I even, one of the big draws of going to school in Providence for college was that RISD was right there, and to try and take more illustrative art courses. So that was part of the idea. But then I just fell more into the writing of it, partly because the classes were more difficult to get into than I had anticipated, and mostly just because I really fell in love with the storytelling aspect of it, and there just wasn't a lot of illustrative art, you know, being taught. I mean, there wasn't a lot of there wasn't a comic book art class at school or anything, right, like, you know, so there wasn't a lot to do in that department, and I just really loved the writing, so I fell more into that. But, you know, I always threaten my guys that I'm going to, like, one day, like, hold them for ransom until I came to a variant for one of my own series or something. But then I see Raphael's art and Greg's art, Francesco, and it's they're so good. It's just it's totally humbling. So, but I would like to do like one variant one day.
Where did you find Raphael? Was that another kind of recommended through somebody or
Raphael?
Yeah,
Raphael was. It was kind of funny. Raphael, when American Vampire went through, before Steve was involved, Steve King at all, it was through and we were all excited. It was like, who's going to draw it? And Will Dennis, who's, you know, a senior editor at Vertigo, recommended Raphael because he was like, he's coming off of Blue Beetle and he, you know, he really is ready to explode on something. And he recommended a few people, and Raphael was the first person to send over sample pages as, like, an audition. And we didn't look at anybody else. As soon as he sent them, actually, if you look at the hardcover or the trade, the paperback for American Vampire, the first volume, at the end, it says character sketches of Pearl and Skinner and vampire studies with their fangs and all that stuff.
Right,
those
right.
were actually his audition pages. Like, that's what he sent. That was the first thing I saw by him was his Skinner.
I'm just looking at him now, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I saw them and I was like, that's the guy. I mean, there was no question once he did that because of the expressiveness, especially that he so got the characters in terms of not just the details and the historical elements and that kind of stuff, like, but just in their gestures and the way they were posed on the page and their attitude. He understood who they were, and I could see how good he was with sort of emotion and stuff on the page. And we knew he was the right one from the start. I think it was issue 13 where he became a co-creator with me on it. And that was really because he deserves it more than anybody. I mean, we were excited to do that. So he's just a brother in arms. I love Raphael to death.
Yeah. His stuff on this is amazing. So I'm curious, I've heard a few floatings around about the origin of American Vampire. How did this thing get made?
Well, what happened, I had done a little bit of Marvel work, like with Iron Man Noir and that stuff, and I got approached by Mark Doyle, the editor of the book at Vertigo, and he asked me if I was interested in pitching. I think he was thinking I was going to pitch more literary stuff to Vertigo, like more of a graphic novel kind of thing, like something along the lines of Day Trippers How to Understand Israel in 60 Days or Less, or that kind of thing. But I came in, and this was a series that I had had in my mind for a while, and I had thought about trying to do as a series of stories, and I had thought about trying to do as a novel, and none of it really felt right. And then once I started doing comics, or even had the opportunity to begin to do comics a couple years earlier, I knew that was the right format for it. And so I went in there, and that was the first thing I pitched. I was like, this is the series. This is what I want to do. And Mark liked it a lot and asked me – he sent me all of these examples of pitches, like the example for Northlanders and all this stuff. So I basically just sort of totally copied Brian Wood's formatting, like just how he did it on the page and just, you know, and wrote one up. And it actually got rejected. The first time around, pretty hardcore rejected, because the feeling really was I started it. It was going to begin with Skinner in the West and talk about how he was caught by Book, all the stuff that's in Steve King's story, but more than that, like or different than that. He really did his own thing with it, but it was going to be this long story about how he was captured and how he got out of the coffin and all this stuff. And they turned it down because they really felt like a series that was a vampire Western wouldn't fly. And, it was like, not just sort of, can you go back and rewrite it? It was really rejected. So I talked to Mark and I was like, you know, he was really heartbroken and I was too. And I was just saying that, you know, what if I knew that it wasn't that, it wasn't a vampire Western, and I had probably just misrepresented it by focusing so much on the opening of it rather than the scope. So I said, well, what if I start in the second cycle and it begins with this woman, Pearl, who I have in mind, and I had just written a couple lines about her. And so then he said, you know, he didn't think that it would really to make that much of a difference, or it might not. It probably wouldn't get a good second chance. But, you know, if I wanted to try it, to try it. So I spent the whole weekend rewriting it and sent it back. And luckily, they really liked it from that standpoint. And they saw what I was, you know, going for with it, and they greenlit it. And so for that, Pearl will always be, like, my favorite character, because she saved the whole series in a lot of ways. And so that's how it went through. And then Steve King got involved because they asked me if I would ask him, because he had written the review and a blurb for my book of short stories, if I would ask him for a blurb for American Vampire, just like a line of press, so that when they announced that it was sold, I could have something to put out there to create kind of buzz. And he read the outline, and he said that he to tell them that, you know, if I wanted, he would be willing to do an issue sometime, because he liked Skinner a lot. And I was like, oh, if I tell them that, they're going to want me to do it right away. And he was skeptical and was sort of like, well, I've never written a comic, and I don't think they'll really want me to do it, because what if I mess it up? And I was like, no, they'll really want you to do it, I promise. And so I told them, and of course they wanted him to do it. And he was going to do one issue, and I sort of scripted it pretty tightly for him. And we learned really quickly, he just didn't like working that way. He really wanted to be able to flex his muscles and you know, live in the world of the story. And it was so exciting to see that. So he wrote like one issue after another issue after another, and I realized that it was going to match mine. So, you know, at first I was super excited, and then I was really nervous, because I was like, oh my God, it's my first big comic. And I'm writing next to Stephen King. I just, like, shot my career in the foot, because everybody's going to like his and hate mine, or everybody's going to read it for him. And then once he's off, it's going to tank. And it was really very nerve-wracking. But, you know, I knew that I was so proud of what he was doing on the book, and I really loved his story, and I was happy with what I was doing. And luckily, people stuck around. So that's the story of how it came to be.
Wow. So you talk about this connection with Stephen King. I mean, this, you said it went back to a short story compilation that you were part of. What was the first connection with him? Like, did he email you? How did you guys get connected?
Oh, no. I mean, blurbs and that stuff is all nepotism and stuff like that. Meaning, like, if you look at a book and you see a quote on it, I promise you the person knows that person in some way or other, has a connection to that person. That's not the reviews, like in the Times and that stuff. But when there's a quote on the book, it's usually the writer's friend or that stuff. So for me with Stephen King, what happened was I had a friend, one of my very good friends, is close to him. I don't want to go specific because my friend gets uncomfortable, honestly. It's not me. I don't mind, I swear. But, you know, I don't like to drag him in to the story a lot. But suffice it to say that I'm close friends with somebody that, yeah, has access to him, and was like, you know, I think that he might really like your collection. And I was like, oh, he's one of my idols, and that would be amazing. And he's like, well, I don't know if he'd really read it. I don't know if he'll have time to read it, but I can at least, you know, help you get it to his desk, you know, or his agent and stuff. So I was like, great, well, that'd be amazing. So he did, and then I didn't really think he'd read it, but he did read it, and then he emailed me saying, you know, that he liked it, and he'd be willing to write, like, a blurb for it, and that was one of just the best days ever of my
life. Wow.
Oh, so, man.
Yeah, and so ever since then, I've stayed in touch with him personally as well, and been, you know, we send him, like, every American Vampire that comes out, and talk to him about it, and what he's doing with his, with Joe, his son, now too, with his new series and stuff like that too. So yeah, we're very close. I mean, and I really hope that one day he'll come back and he'll always be welcome. And, you know, he couldn't have been a greater guy to collaborate with.
Oh man, that's amazing, man. That's I couldn't even imagine waking up to an email from him. That would be incredible.
That's pretty crazy.
Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, but Jeremy, you got any more questions? I keep cutting you off, I think.
No, not at all. I guess what I'd like to know a little bit now is, Scott, your actual scripting process, because obviously that's what this whole podcast is about, is the process of writing comic book. And we had Robert Venditti on last time, and he gave a very detailed account on how he scripts an issue, and I was just curious on what your method is.
Hmm. Let me think. I mean, the way I do it is, it depends. If you mean from, like, the very beginning, like with this Batman story, for example, what I try and do is what's the most important thing to me is to know what it's about for myself, like not just the script for the issue, but the entire thing. So I tend to go pretty long form with my stuff. Like the Swamp Thing story is, you know, 10 issues, and the Batman story is 11 issues, and, you know, Detective was 11 issues and all that kind of stuff. So I try and figure out what that whole arc is about for me. So for this, for the Batman story, it really is about Bruce Wayne being overconfident in terms of his familiarity with Gotham and thinking of Gotham as kind of his oldest friend in some ways, when in fact what Gotham is trying to prove to him is that it's a stranger and an enemy, and that he doesn't know anything about its history that he thought he knew. So once I kind of have that, then what I do is I try and figure out the best way to explore that idea. And that idea usually is based on, you know, the way I get to the idea, I guess, or the first thing is to just figure out what's most exciting to you about the character you're working on. And for me, with Bruce, it's kind of like what you love the most about them. And with Dick, it really was about, like, his empathy and his compassion and, you know, what a good guy he is. And then trying to show him that that's some kind of weakness. You know, taking the thing that you love about the character that you think is one of their greatest strengths, and then trying to prove to them that that thing is actually is an Achilles heel of some kind. Because to me, that's kind of like an easy way of getting at a story that makes you kind of face your worst fears. I think that's always kind of a goal, I guess. So taking the things that you're most proud of and then trying to turn them on their head and show you that they're the things that are actually the most dangerous about yourself. So in that way with Bruce, that's what this is about. And once I know that, like, I can sort of decide, well, how do I best explore that? Well, he should be really confident at first, then I should show how well he knows Gotham or thinks he knows Gotham. And I know that I'm going to do the story all from his point of view. I'm not going to cut to the villain and be showing a villain plotting and stuff. I want it all to be through Bruce's POV. I want the kind of story it's going to be this paranoid, cumulative story that really feels like each step of the way makes you more sort of anxious about who to trust and where these owls could be, these symbols and statues and all this kind of stuff around Gotham. And so once I know that, I guess I move on to breaking it down into the biggest beats of the story. Like, with Detective, it was these little arcs, because I felt like it was like teaching Dick different lessons piece by piece about how cruel Gotham could be and how weak he was, or how weak it was trying to tell him he was, even though it was totally wrong about him. He was, you know, that was his strength, was his empathy. But little by little, it was trying to show him, like, the citizens of Gotham were really, you know, cruel and dark. And then it was trying to show him how bad the crime was in terms of being how his empathy would make him fail. And then the final arc was about how the villain himself in James Jr. was, you know, completely sociopathic and had no sense of empathy or compassion. And in that way, he was up against an enemy that represented everything that was sort of antithetical to him. And with this story with Batman, it's really about this kind of, it has a very different structure where it's much more, I wanted to do something that's more like The Long Halloween or that kind of feeling, where it's almost like this paranoid sort of freight train moving forward where there's no sense of little arcs. It's just chapter by chapter, this growing dread. And so I figure out the big beats, you know, meaning what are the big moments where Batman realizes sort of the big revelations of the thing, of the story, that are going to undermine his sense of competence and really break him psychologically. And once I have those, then I try and break it down into where the issues are going to fall, you know, like where issue one should really begin and end thematically, how much I should tell with each issue. And I draw up an outline for myself that's just a few lines per issue, just saying, like, issue one, introduce readers to, you know, this, the Gotham that you're going to write about, where Bruce really thinks he knows it better than anybody. Make sure you do that. And, you know, you can hint at the mystery and that stuff, but this is really an issue about Bruce being confident and being in control. The second issue, try and show the same thing. He thinks he knows all this stuff about the history of Gotham, show how badass he is, but, you know, then you begin to twist it where this villain pops up who can't really exist if Bruce is right, and then at the same time is somehow unstoppable. Issue 3, which is coming up, is about Bruce now sort of failing to accept evidence that's mounting, whereas other people like Jim Gordon and Nightwing are starting to say, Bruce, is there something, do you have some history with this? What's the matter? Like, why won't you sort of take the facts as they stand? And that's how I guess I do it. And then the script itself, each one, I try and figure out, is this what you mean, by the way?
Yeah. Because I was curious on, I guess you don't, dialogue, you don't, how much time would you spend on dialogue? Or once you figure out all of these bigger beats, smaller beats, issue breakdowns, does it just kind of flow?
Well, I spend a lot of time on that stuff, you know, but once I know what's going to happen in the issue based on that kind of larger outline, like once I figured out, well, I want to have this big intro where it's really about Bruce being able to take down his rogues gallery pretty well without help, and just to show that that stuff is old and now we're going to a new chapter, even though those villains aren't old at all, and, you know, I'm going to be writing about them again soon too. But just for the purposes of the story, he's fought them before, and they're enemies that he's dealt with and stuff. And I knew I wanted that, and then after that, you know, show the family that he's comfortable, show the manner, show all the stuff that makes him feel at home, and then sort of twist it at the very end. And once I know that, then I think to myself, well, how can I best, I guess, how do I best get across the thing that the issue is about, which is if it's about him feeling confident, then why don't I start with something that's about him defining Gotham? And then I thought, well, what's the most interesting way I could do that, at least that I can come up with? And for me, it was this sort of, well, what if I made up a column where everybody thinks they knows what it is?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Thanks. And then I go back and then I make up the column and then I overlay it. I was like, well, you know, you don't want to just listen to him, so why not? He's so good at fighting his villains, he'll be talking to you while he's fighting them. Like, the narration will go over him fighting them, so there's not even the same level of suspense in the fight because he's narrating to you. So when that happens, it undercuts the tension in the scene because it's not just totally active. It's not just the scene happening, you know? So then I guess when it comes to dialogue and narration, though, my scripting process really is to write them as a block, to write them without breaking the panels. So, for example, like, that narration at the beginning of Batman 1, I wrote as one long chunk.
Oh, I see.
And I looked at it and said, okay, what should I put, how should I break it so that it falls well with different panels? And then the dialogue, you know, with the family, I write back and forth, and then I break it into panels. And the same thing with an issue 2, you know, the speech at the beginning and his dialogue with Nightwing. I try and write those just without worrying about where they're going to fall. And then I go back and then I insert the panel breakdown. And then I let that dictate sort of the length of those scenes. And if they seem a little too long, I chop them up. But maybe it's coming from a prose background. It's just that those things, the action sequences and the things that are more... that are more high octane, those I do visually without worrying about the narration and the dialogue, like if it's a fight and that stuff pretty much. And I, you know, if I try and I just write it out visually and then go back and insert the stuff. But for the scenes that are really emotional and that are heavily reliant on the dialogue and narration, I write that part first and then break them into panels, I guess, if that answers your question.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting.
I think it's great because a lot of people, myself included, when I started writing scripts, I was focusing more on, you know, obviously the beats that are necessary on just getting a page turner going so people would be interested in reading the story and making sure, you know, page turners ended on odd or even number pages and all that. But I like the fact that you're talking about thinking wider than that, thinking in a broader context, and that the story kind of stems from those concepts, which is really, really fascinating.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's different too, writing Batman, than it was Detective in that regard, where, you know, to me, Detective was almost more reliant on that stuff. Like, because it's so mystery based and so hard edged and so gritty, and that it really did fall a lot more around the dialogue and narration. And this Batman is a better balance, I think. Like there's a lot of stuff that is just as important that happens in action and just in visuals. I'm learning to let go a little bit, I think, of the dialogue and narration, not in terms of letting it slip, but I mean, letting the artists do a little more speaking than I used to be able to do. So I think I'm growing a lot on this one. And, you know, you work differently with each artist as well.
Sure.
Well, I know I've been with Green Wake. Riley has had to, like, he emails me back and says, you know, there's no way we can fit this much dialogue in here. He's like, cut half that crap out. So I've had to go back after and, you know, make some revisions. And that's definitely something I learned on Green Wake, because I find it a lot harder with a mystery story not to narrate too much. And yeah, once I learned to trust him with the actual characterization, I felt that I didn't have to say as much. It was just a lot more evident in the way he was illustrating it.
Yeah, that's exactly. And I feel that way about the guys I'm working with too. And then there are also things I'm just learning how better to tell the story without worrying so much about, you know, getting it on the nose all the time in dialogue and narration and stuff, and, you know, just giving it more breathing room. You know, I'm learning to trust a little bit more. I think even with artists that I've been working with a long time, like Raphael, you get used to writing back and forth in certain ways. So I'm used to filling it with lots of dialogue and narration. And then we just started doing this new issue where there's a huge silent portion of it. And I'm looking at it thinking, God, I wish I'd tried this earlier with him, you know? And
yeah,
it's not that for any failing on his part in terms of getting to tell the story well that he'd been doing. It's just I hadn't thought of, you know, trying it that way or anything. And then you try it and you're like, it's amazing how much can be conveyed visually that you didn't anticipate just through the tiniest things when you're working with a good artist like these guys.
Do you find that, like, in a lot of your scripts now, or even I guess before at any time, did you take control of the camera a lot, or were your points fairly I guess open to interpretation?
Yeah, I don't do that a lot, actually. I really do steer clear of that, meaning I've seen a lot of other scripts that by other writers that do all kinds of different things, from you know, being really open in terms of the directorial aspect, and then other ones that are extremely detailed about, you know, like pull back to show this as a medium shot from the, as though we're in the ceiling, and, you know, this is how you do it, and, you know, with drawings to show, and that's great too. There's nothing qualitatively better about one or the other. For me, I think it's partly just, again, enjoying the collaboration a lot, in terms of liking to work with artists who are willing to take on a lot of creative decisions. I mean, that was one of the things that also was one of the first questions I asked Raphael when he came on American Vampire, was that would he be willing to make a lot of those decisions, because I wasn't necessarily interested in being in control of every panel that way. It was more what I do with him is I say, I mean, I should show you a script, but for example, let me think what's coming up. Swamp Thing 3, which is coming out Wednesday. Can you give me 1 second and I will pull
up? Yeah, for sure.
I'll pull up Swamp Thing 3 and I'll tell you, like, how it opens.
Well, while you're doing that, one of the things that I knew, even with Riley, that I've learned is I have done that where I've said, you know, this is the way I want the camera to look at it, and he just ignores it half the time anyways. And then he makes the executive decision, and it actually works out for the best. At first, it kind of was like, hey, you know, this is kind of what I was thinking, but 90% of the time, he really makes it his own, and it works just, you know, just as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're working with somebody you really like, I feel like part of the fun is letting them flex their muscles and bring what they're going to bring to the story, you know, without you telling them, I don't know, everything that they're going to do. But then again, that's not to knock people who do it differently. Again, it's just my personal taste. you know, the last thing I want to do is say, oh, well, that's how you're supposed to do it, because it's not. I mean, other people do it completely differently, and it works really well for them. So I'll tell you, here's a better example, because Swamp Thing 3, I have it on my desktop, and I'm talking to you from my laptop, but okay. I have American Vampire here. Let me see. I have American Vampire, the new one, coming out.
So while you're pulling that up, how far ahead are you on most of your projects? Are you quite a few issues ahead? Are you done entire arcs already?
Yeah, I mean, I try and get really far ahead, honestly, just because, with Swamp Thing, I'm through 7, and Batman, I'm through 7, and American Vampire, I'm through 25, so I try and stay pretty far ahead, honestly, because I feel like, it just gives me some breathing room, and
How fast would you say you write an issue?
It usually takes me, I work pretty, the full day on it, you know, or my work day is a little difficult now that we have the baby and stuff, only because we have a babysitter from about 9 to 5, but I pick my son up from school at 2, and I drop him off at 9, so I work from about 9 to 2 pretty straight, and then I pick him up and bring him home, and then I work again for another hour or so usually, or sometimes I'm just exhausted and take a nap with the baby because of the baby, but I usually try and get in another hour of work or so and then hang out with him. And after they go to sleep, usually try and work for another hour or so. So it takes me, I would say if I work like that, it takes me about 3 days to do a script, 2 to 3 days. And then to look it over, I spend the last couple days of the week looking it over and editing it, and then I send it in to the editor and then get some notes and go back and do it.
Nice.
You know, so something like that. So it really is about a week of script. So with 3 series running for me now, because Severed is done, you know, I have a week off, but it's not really off. I mean, I take the week to go ahead. That's where I can start to get ahead. So
yeah.
So anyway, with issue 22, again, I have a good working relationship with Raphael, so we can talk in shorthand now. But it says, you know, American Vampire, issue 22. It says, Raphael, page 1. Raphael, I couldn't be more excited for this arc. I know you are too. When I typed issue 22, I had to stop. 22 issues. I can't believe we're this far along. Anyway, here we go. The feel of this arc should be youth gone wild, like 50s teens out of control. Racing hot rods and having knife fights, punks in black like our hero, corrupting innocent high school girls in tight sweaters and poodle skirts, everything dramatic and tense as though it's italicized and has 3 exclamation points on the end. I did that. I just want the story to have that 1950s hysterical feel. It has to do with the fear of youth, fear of rebellion, fear that girls and guys have become vicious and wild and uncontrollable rock and roll sex machines. And then I gave 2 pages of pictures of, Rumble, and it's teens about to kill each other with knives. And then it's Teenage Crime Wave, the new movie by Cook McCart, and then High School Hellcats, and I'm in a Motorcycle Gang, and that kind of stuff, all for him. The series, it's not campy or anything, this issue, by the way. It's very straight ahead, but just to give him a sense of a kind of tone, and it's Young and Wild, Juvenile Jungle, a girl joins a gang just for kicks, Hot Rod Girl, and then anyway, it gets past all these references, and then I gave him a number of YouTube clips, and then it says for real, and then it's panel one. It's Raphael, this page is about focusing really close to the ground on a tiny event, the interaction between a scorpion and a lizard fighting in the dirt. So then it says, an overhang, a ledge that looks down over a California town, a really pretty sight. The kind of view that kids would park at and look at night, twinkling lights. And in the corner of the panel, a simple lizard, a gecko, small, harmless, and cute. And then it says, the caption is, our hero is Travis Kidd, and he's a teenage rockabilly sort of dropout punk. but he's also secretly the best vampire killer out there. He's like our Van Helsing. So you don't know that's what he does yet. You think that he's just a regular. Now I'm spoiling it, but you think he's just a regular teenager.
God damn you.
Yeah. And he's all like, he goes into this whole thing about how he saw this egghead on TV who was talking about the teenage brain and the three things that it can't understand. And then those three things form his narration over the course of the four issues that you're going to read with him. He comes back to it in each issue and tells you another one. This one is about death, this egghead says on the tube that kids today don't understand. They can't understand death because their brains weren't made for it, and that since caveman days, it helps evolve the species and push it forward by not having the youth be able to be afraid of death, because then you push your limits and stuff. And he's like, well, you know, he's like, I don't know about that guy, but he never met me. And then this, you're watching the scorpion fight the lizard, and then this car smushes them both as it goes over for page two. And then page two and three is a double splash of these two hot rods racing, and it's Travis is in one, Travis Kidd, and you don't know who's in the other one. It's a vampire that he's been chasing his whole life, who he thinks is responsible for ruining everything and turning him into the guy he is today.
Wow.
And so the whole arc is actually framed by this race in the present that becomes more and more out of control, too. So it's not just a race. It gets, like, to a whole, you know, stake and gun and firefight, everything. But the race forms the framework for it, and he's after this vampire, and he's really badass. He basically has this set of wooden fangs he keeps with him, and when he finally takes down a vampire right before he kills him, he rips their throat out with these wooden fangs because he likes to bite them back. That's what he says. He's like, I like to bite them back. And then that's the covers of the whole series. Raphael did them as though they're like 50s ads. So the cover for it is Travis with these wooden fangs leaning on a jukebox, and it says, bite them back, in this like really cheerful, like Tide dishwashing kind of. The second one is even better. It's like this car. It looks like an automobile ad, and it says, it's like, you know, the newest model, spacious trunk for any kind of luggage. And the trunk's a little open, and you see these bloody legs hanging out of it. So anyway, it's huge fun. I mean, it's this arc we really wanted to be the beginning of the second half of the 20th century for us, and so the beginning of kind of the second volume of our series, where we're moving away from certain characters, you know, like Skinner, who was killed in issue 18, and, you know, people keep asking whether or not he'll be back, but I can't say, honestly, at this point. I mean, I can say, but I'm not going to say at this point. But then, you know, we're going to catch up with Pearl, and we're going to catch up with Henry, and it really begins the second chapter in their lives as well. But we wanted to really introduce you to some new characters and, you know, and pick up with Calvin and a lot of other characters from that we've introduced in small ways. So we're super excited about it. And this guy is sort of the guy we've been dying to get to for a long time, Travis. And he's sort of a character that means a lot to both me and Raphael. And, you know, and at the end of the day, he has a secret that also ties into the past of American Vampire and an arc that came before this one, too. So he's connected to the history of it.
Nice. So do you have like some kind of a visual diagram for the progress of your characters in different, because you do jump a lot of timelines with this series. Do you have some kind of visual cues for that?
Yeah, Mark keeps it, our editor. He holds our feet to the fire with that, where I'm always like, yeah, and Abilina could be in this one. And then he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He'll be like, Abilina would be 89 years old if she was born here. And I'm like, oh, man. So, you know, he keeps us honest in that regard and has, like, a very good timeline about how old the characters will be and when they were born and all that stuff, when this happened or that happened. So I have a pretty good mind for it, but, you know, I definitely sometimes jump the gun on that stuff.
Scott, what, you know, I know that some people say when they're writing that sometimes the writing itself, the characters speak for themselves. I was curious on what inspires you to come up with these new arcs, to come up with, you know, characters. Is it stuff you see during your days, just, you know, living your life, or is it something that you get inspired from just writing the material, you know, day in, day out?
Well, I guess it's a little bit of both. I mean, for me, the way I approach something like American Vampire is to try and figure out, I know we're moving, or we have the opportunity at least, to move to a new decade with each arc, or to move to, you know, a different part of the same decade. And what I try and do at first is figure out what's most interesting to me given the characters we have already. So for the 40s, you know, for example, I try and figure out, I know I want to do a World War II story in general, but I try and figure out where Pearl and Henry will be. And for me, it really felt like, well, Henry's going to be getting a little bit older. He's going to be feeling his mortality. Maybe that's a good sticking point. And then maybe what if he's not allowed to join up because he's older and he's injured? And what if the vassals approach him and say, well, yeah, you can't join up, but you can join up with us and we'll go fight vampires. And I was like, that's the story I want, because that,
nice.
That really brings him to a place that's completely reflective of what's going on with him psychologically and emotionally. And how could I do that? Well, I'll bring him to a really isolated island somewhere instead of bringing him to the Western, or to Europe, where he's going to be fighting with tons of people in a big battle. I'll make him on this remote island. And then I thought, well, you know, how do I get Pearl in there? And what would Skinner be doing? And so it happens that way. I try and figure out where in their trajectory or their arc, you know, in terms of their life, the characters will be. And then I try and let that dictate what part of the decade and what place and what context I create, so that it's somehow a reflection of what's happening with them emotionally and psychologically, or at least a challenge for them in a way that explores that aspect of their psychology or their sort of emotional life that's interesting to me about that moment and it's in their progression. So that's one lens that I use
a
lot.
Do you ever get stuck when you're writing stuff? And if you do, how do you break through that?
Well, I do get stuck. I mean, or, you know, I haven't gotten stuck yet, I guess, with these, but it's mostly the way I get around getting stuck, honestly, is that I figure out what it's about for me before I start. And you have to really buy into it yourself. So for me, I knew that I really cared about that idea about Henry feeling his own mortality and needing to prove that he was still a part of things in the world, and then realizing what a mistake that was. And once I buy into that, I really feel that this is true for anyone out there that's like an aspiring writer. The plot and stuff, you can make missteps. Like, you can screw up your pacing and you can screw up your twist ending and that stuff. But if you have your emotional arc there and your characterization down where it really matters to you what this character is going through issue to issue, and you put that on the page, fans and readers will forgive you the rest of the stuff, and the rest of the stuff is also becomes much more flexible. And I'd say in comics it's really important, because you get a lot of editorial suggestions when you work in superhero comics especially. I working with Mike Mertz has been a dream at Batman, because he is known for not giving you a lot of those notes in the best way, where he gives you big notes, but they're general notes, like guiding notes, and he doesn't give you, you know, lots of things to add and change, which, you know, sometimes can be great. I'm not knocking that again, but for me personally, I get frustrated sometimes seeing writers when they get plot things thrown at them. It really throws them off, you know. And I feel bad a lot for some of my friends that happens to, because I don't get those suggestions, not because my story is more intact than theirs was. It's just because of the neighborhood I work in Batman, where we're given a little bit more latitude. But when I'm talking to them, you know, again, about fixing the story, sometimes what I'd say is that for me too, when I get a suggestion, if I ever get one, now and then, which I do, I get them sometimes, I mean, about adding something plot-wise or this or that, that seems at the moment, you're like, well, how am I supposed to fit that in? In comics, it's a really normal occurrence for that to happen. Like, oh, well, we have an event coming up with, you know, Shazam. Can you put that in your script? And it's like, how could I possibly put Shazam in here? Well, it came down from on high, so put Shazam in there. And then you're like, oh, my God, how do I put Shazam in my script? It has nothing to do with Shazam. But that really does happen. And what I would say is that if you know what your story is about emotionally for the character, you can get around that stuff, meaning you can figure out a way of either like coupling that to what's happening to your character like, because the whole project, it doesn't become about fitting it in somehow in a plot way, which becomes a Rubik's Cube. Honestly, if you're just dealing with plot, in my opinion,
yeah,
it becomes really difficult to, like, well, how do I make that happen? How do I... It doesn't really matter how you make it happen if you can make it make sense emotionally to the character, meaning it's less important to figure out the logistics of what Shazam can do in your story than it is just showing Shazam and using it metaphorically to underscore what you're trying to get at emotionally for your character. And if you can do that, even if it seems incongruous in terms of the plot, readers will buy into it and like it the way you do, because it's not about fitting something in there like a Tetris thing, like for a plot. It's about
right.
just making a connection that's deeper between that material and what you're trying to do. So I guess that's the best advice I can give in that department, is if you know that, if you really know what it's about and you care about what it's about for your character, it's a lot easier to get unstuck when you get stuck. So I haven't gotten too stuck and so far, and you know, I'm sure I'll jinx it now by saying that, but you know, I have a lot of plans for stuff like American Vampire, where some cycles are deeply about the characters that are already there, and then other cycles like this. We're doing 250 cycles, for example. One is this one I just told you about, which introduces new character. It's supposed to feel fresh and young, and it's about vampires in terms of the same theme, where it's about young, about youth saying, you guys are old, you vampires, you know, we're young vampires, you're old vampires, you're done. You know, all that. It says this whole theme running through it. The second one, though, is the second story is really going to be about Pearl and Henry and stuff, and where they are and Calvin. And in that way, that one is much more about using the 50s as a way of, and the paranoia of the Blacklist and the sense of they're coming to get us and don't say the wrong thing and all that kind of stuff. Because to me, when I think about how they've been living, that's kind of the most interesting aspect to me of, with the, I can't give too much away about where they're going to be, but about what's going on in their lives, that fits right in. So to where they're going to be in terms of, you know, where, how old Henry is and what's happened to the two of them and everything. So in that way, I try and figure it out in terms of those characters. In this way, I just try and think about what's interesting to me about the decade for the first arc. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
For the first arc, I mean, it's all new. It's new characters, because we wanted to do a 50s story that's all about the stuff we love in the 50s, meaning the wild combination of things that's coming about in rock and roll and youth and cars and all the stuff that makes it feel like a new moment. And this arc is about that. Then we also wanted to do one that's really about the characters that we already have. So we use that other lens, like I was saying earlier, about where they are emotionally to figure out how to craft that story. So it's sort of, they're two different kind of modes, I guess. One is just, they're both about figuring out what's most exciting to you about that thing, but one is about figuring out what's most exciting about, you know, the decade and the time period, which is how Severed came about. And then the other way is, now that we have long-running characters that we love, it's about figuring out where they are at the moment and then building a story that explores the thing you're most interested in about them in particular.
Just to comment what you said earlier about how sometimes if you work with plot, you said you haven't experienced it too much, but you obviously have friends who had. Is it frustrating for them when they get, you know, there's critical reviews out there that state the worst part about that was that incision that was made kind of against their will? That
Absolutely.
Must be kind of a frustrating experience.
Absolutely. It's very frustrating. I know it is for them. And I feel terrible about it. I mean, but, you know, it's not that the suggestions are so awful or that the suggestions are, you know, it really is just that, you know, there are things that need to be done editorially sometimes. And that's part of comics. Like, you have to adjust. I mean, I've had things thrown at me that way, too. Like, I mean, I had the backups lopped off of Detective, and I had the characters that I wasn't supposed to use, that I wanted to use, and I had already written in, all that kind of stuff, you know, in Batman and everything. So it happens. But if you know what the thing is about, you can figure your way around it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I like your analogy of when you're plotting, where if you're just focusing all on that, it becomes this Rubik's Cube, and it becomes this daunting task where it's like a puzzle when it really shouldn't be, because, you know, if you look at it from a wider scale, you know, there's lots of room.
Yeah, that's all I mean. It's like if I'm reading Batman and you say to me, Superman needs to be in that issue. This hasn't happened to me, so Superman won't be appearing in Batman. So don't forget that. But if you said, well, Superman has to appear in it because we're doing a big feature on Superman, and, you know, I'd say, no, I don't want him in there. And they'd say, yes, he has to be in there. And I'd say, okay, fine, I'll do it. And then you figure out, well, not what can Superman do to my plot, but why don't I just open on him talking to Superman about whatever it is that the story's really about and think about what Superman would offer in that conversation that would really cut at the stuff that Bruce doesn't see. And that's nice. How I would put Superman in there, you know what I mean? But I feel like a lot of the time the immediate impulse by other writers sometimes is to try and figure out a plot way of getting him involved so that he plays a big part plot-wise. And then that can become a real dangerous game, I think, just because then what your story is about, I think, sometimes can really go off the rails issue to issue. You know, and that's, again, I feel like this sounds really presumptuous, like I'm saying, oh, I know how to do it. And I don't. I'm just saying that's the way it works for me personally. And if I have advice to give, which could be absolutely the wrong advice, I'm sure. But to me, if I had advice that I believed in to give, that would be part of it, would be to try and script that way so that you don't worry about so much how to make what they're suggesting. As a comics thing, you will get lots of things thrown at you, so you have to learn to – how do you incorporate those? For me, that's the way I do that is, okay, you're going to lop off the backup? Okay, I can deal with that because I know that the story is about this, this, and this. I'll figure out a way of getting that material in there at a different moment. Fine, that's just plotting. As long as I have what I had in terms of the emotional beat of that issue there for Dick Grayson – that's okay. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or I'll just work in the same emotional beat with Jim Gordon in a conversation with them. So he says something about his son. So I understand where he is emotionally. Then I don't need my backup. But then when the backup comes back, I'll move it along plot-wise. But it'll be about the emotion again in a different way. So you figure it out that way instead of thinking, uh-oh, the stuff that happened in the backup is essential to the plot. Well, how do I figure out how to get that stuff in there plot-wise? I just say, forget it. I'll just figure out the plot. I'll just take that part of the plot out as long as the emotional stuff's still there. Do you know, I feel like, I hope this is making sense.
It does. That's
absolute sense.
That's really solid. I think that's some of the best advice we've probably heard. That's really awesome.
Yeah.
I've even learned something from that myself. That's great. That really makes a lot of sense to me. Well, I guess, you know, we're coming up to the end here. I'm just want to, I guess, what was your highlight, I guess, for 2011?
My
so
highlight,
far.
Wow.
The highlight, what was the highlight?
Every time I think there's one, something else comes along. I mean, in terms of professionally, if I sing highlight of my year, we had a baby, and you know, there's a lot of things like that. But professionally, I mean, just getting to, honestly, I mean, I'm working on my two favorite characters in the DCU between Batman and Swamp Thing. And then I have my own series, you know, that there isn't anything that is an highlight right now. I mean it. Like, I feel extremely grateful to DC, but also to you guys and everybody reading me. I mean, this is my absolute dream job, and I swear to everybody out there, like, I will do everything that is humanly possible within my power not to write a bad comic ever. Because I never want to be kicked off this job ever. I love it. So, I mean, this is what I would like to do forever, so I promise I will do my absolute best to keep things as good as I can, no matter what, on every issue.
Excellent.
You're setting the standard high, my friend.
I'm trying. I promise. I think, like, Swamp Thing 3 is our best issue, and Batman 3 is our best issue so far. And I mean, I say it. I wouldn't say it if I really didn't think so, because then I'd look stupid.
No, you know, it's true. I can't get a copy of Swamp Thing number one. I still have yet to read it because I can't find a copy.
I sent Ryan a copy of three, I send my comps out sometimes for CBR and for review sites just so that they can get a copy early. So I just send them out myself. DC sort of, like, they're not thrilled about it, but they let you do it if it's just your hard copies and your comps and stuff like that, because they just don't want reviews running early and stuff. But I feel like it gives you guys a little extra time, so you
know, right.
Do it. But because what am I going to do with all the comps anyway? It's the other thing. So, you know. But anyway, you know, the with that, I really feel like our upcoming issues are our best, and I'd really look dumb if I said it and then it wasn't true, but I mean it. I would just not say anything if I thought our next issue wasn't as good as the one before. I'd be like, check it out, tell us what you think. But I would go on record as saying I really think Swamp Thing 3 and Batman 3 are our best so far.
Oh, awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I just finished Batman number 2 yesterday, and I love the shit out of it. So.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate
it. Well, I said before, like, you know, I wasn't a huge DC reader at all. Like, it wasn't something that I'd followed. I, you know, I only came into comics about 6 or 7 years ago, and there was so much continuity. And when I heard some of the writers that were going to be involved with the relaunch, like you and Lemire, and I really like Lemire. He's a nice guy. I've met him a few times. And you know what, I think I'll give these a shot. And yeah, I mean, a lot of them really surprised me, and I was really excited about it. So you guys are doing great work on it, for sure.
Thanks, man. I mean, Jeff is, again, a good friend, but also even if I hated his guts, I would have to admit that I think Animal Man is the best series out there.
It's pretty solid.
Like, bar none. And I've read it through issue 7. I can promise you it stays just as good, if not better, as it goes forward. I mean, it does not drop the ball anywhere. Like, it's inspiring. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, if I didn't like Jeff as much as I do as a friend, I would be really jealous. But I read it, and I really do. I'm just happy for him and excited for him, and I'm happy to promote it. And there are a lot of other books like that, too, I'm really excited about coming out, you know, whether it's whether it's what's coming up in Nightwing, or, you know, Gail's Batgirl, or also books that I think are under the radar still, like All-Star Western, which I think is really good. And Justice League Dark and iVampire, a lot of the dark ones I'm a fan of, surprise, surprise. But Pete's Batman and Robin, I think, is one of those ones that's sort of an unsung hero of the Bat world, too, right now, where people are used to him doing a good job, and they don't see when he does things that I think are maybe a little bit above what he normally does. And here I think he's really bringing it, you know. And I don't know, it's an exciting thing to be a part of. I mean, it, like Wonder Woman, for example, you know, alone is, it's a thrill to be a part of something where that comic book is coming out beside you, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I never would have suspected Azzarello to be on that book. That when that announcement came out, I was just, it took a second for me to really think that I'd heard it correctly.
Well, that was one of the funniest things, was like I heard about that a long time ago before there was a relaunch, and I got on Swamp Thing before there was a relaunch, and I saw him a year ago. I guess it was a year ago? It wasn't this C2E2. It was like last C2E2. And we were talking, and I was like, God, I heard you're doing Wonder Woman with Cliff. And he's like, yeah, yeah, it's, you know, on hush hush. We haven't started it yet, but here's my take on it. He told me. And he's like, I heard you're doing Swamp Thing. He was like, and I heard your take on it. And he's like, it's arrogant. And I was like, oh, no. And he's like, that's what he said. He goes, that was the first thing. He goes, it's arrogant. And he's
wow.
Like, but it's the only way to do it. And I was like, I can breathe, you know. He's so funny. He's like so – he has an act that he's – and Brian, I hope you're not listening, but he's an act that he's like, you know, really cranky and really scary and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But deep down, he'll kill me for saying it. But he's also a real, you know, enthusiast and lover of all things superhero, or at least these iconic characters. And, you know, that's why when – he told me his take on Wonder Woman, you knew it was somebody that really had a story that was going to get to the core of what makes the character so cool and take it in a different direction while without stepping on stuff that came before.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy for him and Cliff with the way that series is going and what's coming up in it too. And yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, I love being a part of the 52, and I'm not saying that as, you know, Mr. Company Man DC. They've given me a chance to write my two, you know, literally two of my absolute favorite characters in the DCU, Batman being my absolute top number one superhero of all time. There's nobody I'd rather write in the world than Batman. And then Swamp Thing being right beneath that. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know, like, who I murdered in some past life and, like, sold to hell. But I must have done something, because definitely I'm lucking out on this stuff.
Well, you're doing some awesome work, man, and we really appreciate you coming on the show. And I know we had a bit of a complication before. This one will air.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's this one will get out there. I can see on my screen here that it is recorded. So We'll make sure that you hear about it when it comes out. So thanks again, man. Really appreciate your time tonight.
No, thank you guys. I really appreciate it. And, you know, again, thanks to everybody reading us. It means a lot.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the end of this episode. Thanks again to Scott Snyder for coming on and talking a little bit about the books he's working on. We have lots of more really great guests lined up, and we look forward to making announcements about those very soon. So we will talk again very soon.